Hello, I'm Joanna Lumley. I'm in my garden in London and I'm walking down the garden path to the music room. In there, I'll find my husband, the composer and conductor, Stephen Barlow. Now, we've been married almost 40 years, and I think, however long you've been with someone, you have questions that you'd like to ask your partner. So this podcast is my chance to ask Stephen the questions I've always wanted to ask him about one of his and my greatest passions, classical music. Hello, Maestro. I call you Stevie. Do you mind me calling you Stevie on these podcasts? Would you rather not? Would you rather I call you Stephen?
It's being recorded.
Yes, it is. It's really the first time in our long life together that we've sat and talked and talked and talked about music.
This is a privilege for me to talk about the biggest thing in my life and what I do and think about every day.
Welcome to Joanna and the Maestro. My name is Joanna Lumley and I'm married to Stephen Barlow. The reason we've called this programme Joanna and the Maestro is partly vanity and partly because it explains what we do, which is that I'm just Joanna, but he is the Maestro, which means that he's a musician and a conductor. Because it's usually, is it just conductors or is it fine musicians?
So very distinguished soloists get the title, but it is most commonly a formal way of addressing the conductor. Mm. If an orchestra called me maestro in my 20s, they were definitely having a laugh. So can I remember when someone called me maestro without a tinge of sardonic wit? Probably when I was in my late 40s, it began. And now it makes me laugh a lot because friends I've known all my life have started calling me maestro, and I'm not quite sure what that means.
So, Joanna and the Maestro. I'm Joanna and the Maestro, Stephen Barlow, sitting opposite me in what sounds quite grand, Stevie, but it is our music room. Can you describe it?
It's wonderful for acoustics, and with a wooden floor, which resonates, and brick, which is porous, so it soaks up echo. You have warmth, but no echo.
And we've got some instruments in here. We've got your grand piano, which is a Steinway.
Steinway,
B.
Yeah. Model B.
And what does that mean?
You bought it for me.
Oh, okay, don't put it
as
like
an engagement present, in case you've forgotten.
A piano. No, don't let's put it like that. We'll have to cut that out. But look, that's not a concert grand, is it? That's a concert grand.
A concert grand is the biggest beast.
Yeah.
Then there's a Model B.
Which is this.
Which is this. And then there's a Model A.
Yeah.
And then reductions in size down to baby and boudoir.
Anyway, this gives a kind of colour of what we want these talks to be about. Talks, that sounds ghastly. What I mean to say is that I've spent my married life, what is it, 37 years, Stevie?
Yes,
37
it
years. Time, yes. I've spent my married life with Stephen asking him questions about music because I love music with all my heart. I can't read music, I can follow it, but for some reason my mind, which I'd like to say is as agile as a flea, somehow can't manage looking at numbers and looking at dots, what the musicians call the dots, i.e. the notes on staves.
But you say you can follow it.
Well, of course I can, because you can see the shape. You can see a flurry of notes, or you can see a thing going up quite high and quite low. So I can follow it, but I can't read it. So if you gave me this and said, sing this, it would take me about 25 minutes to do a bar to work out what it was.
Well, you didn't you come into any contact at all with...
with
music... With music lessons?
Yes, of course I did. I showed by playing by ear on a piano. We came back from the Far East and we had a little rented house in Epsom when Daddy was working in the War Office for a bit.
And you were how old?
I suppose I was about 8 when we came back from Malaya, and my father had a job in the War Office, and we had a little house in Epsom which had a piano in it. And because I could hear tunes in my head, and I bing-bonged on the piano, and you go, oh, look, 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 this is the tune. And I'd never had a piano before.
Did they buy the piano?
No, it was just in the house. It was a rented house. It was a rented house
and
with rented
furniture.
And you
had an upright piano.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so I could pick out little tunes on it. And I did things like lullabies and spinning songs and things like this.
Blimey.
But I did do it with both hands. And I can remember Mummy looking at me with a bit of a frown, and then she went off and talked to Daddy and said, maybe she should have piano lessons, because she's showing some small signs of liking music.
Yeah.
So then we went to piano music, and this, of course, was my immediate downfall, because I realised that just as with numbers, where eventually I was asked to give up maths because I'm dyslexic, numerically dyslexic, whatever that is called, I can't see the notes. So no matter how much I tried, I would say to my music teacher, will you play it?
Mm.
So I can A, watch your hands, and B, listen to it, because I couldn't read it. Now, you've always said to me, oh, yes, but you must try, try, try. I tried and tried because I really wanted to know how to do music. But I realised I couldn't do it through my eyes. I could only do it through what I heard and watching other people's fingers.
So neither your ma or pa had music lessons either?
No, but they both love music. Daddy liked to tinker around by ear.
Ah, well,
he played by ear.
Then you were off and running, really, because a child hearing a parent at the piano is an inspiration.
Yeah.
It's part of your life.
We didn't have a piano when we were growing up in Malaya and faraway lands, but we did have music everywhere. I can remember growing up with Beethoven's Pastoral Symphony, number 6 in F major. You know, there's so much vitality in this piece of music. Beethoven was a lover of nature, and he said Symphony number 6 was more the expression of feeling than painting. As well as Beethoven's Pastoral Symphony, there was also Mozart's Eine kleine Nachtmusik. We'd listen to it all on the wind-up gramophone. My mother loved Serenade number 13. Those wonderful strings. Do you know, it surely has to be one of Mozart's most recognisable pieces of music, but it's still just absolutely exquisite in its delicacy. But she didn't care for opera, so we never heard opera.
It was a thing then, and it was exactly the same in my family. No one became a musician, and no one read music, as far as I can tell, way back. But music was part of their lives. They had their ears open and their minds open to what was regarded as a normal part of growing up and a normal part of culture. But the important thing was that it never went any further with you, did it?
I did play the piano for a bit, and then I asked if I could give it up.
And there was no provision of any kind of instrumental opportunity, was there, at your schools?
No, I got hold of a recorder, and I could play a white sport coat and a pink carnation when everybody else had Spanish flu. So that, I don't think, helped them on their way. But I didn't get Spanish flu. I always wanted to play the piano because it seemed to me that on a piano, you could get a completely rounded, complete sound. Whereas if you were playing, for instance, a French horn or only a violin or only a clarinet, I'm only saying these in terrible inverted commas, but a piano could be the whole piece. So I always loved piano, and I adored, first of all, funnily enough, the music that was played at the dance classes in Malaya. So you can imagine a ceiling fan whipping round and outside dark jungles and a house propped up on stilts and wooden boards and all of us little girls with our dancing shoes and a basket which had salted water to drink because it was so hot and sweaty. And somebody playing Offenbach's Barcarolle, that lovely rocking boat song, and dancing to that and I can hear it to this day.
Yes, that's the introduction to the barcarolle from Offenbach's final opera, Tales of Hoffmann. And the introduction opens full of promise with the magical strings laying the ground for the perfectly swaying gondola in the fab melody.
And Chopin I got to love, and I used to ask for Chopin, those EP records. Do you remember? They were the size of 45, extended play. And you'd get two etudes or two nocturnes on each side.
So you were buying recordings?
Yes. Oh, God, yes.
What, in your teens?
Yes, and at school we all came back and we were given as a birthday present, you'd do that thing, you'd go, oh, I can't guess what this is, because it would be an LP. And inside it was always a piece of classical music.
But your love of music, it went very, very deep, didn't it? It wasn't just a, well, I've got a few records.
No.
But I'm interested too in... When you were a teenager, pop music was beginning to take over and you became a real lover of Elvis Presley in particular.
Yeah.
Did you ever feel any conflict? With
no.
No,
not both, even for a second.
They were both gifts, weren't they?
Not for a second. And everything that I loved in music, which was usually, it usually was pretty gorgeous. I liked pretty gorgeous music. So I loved the Everly Brothers. And and I then was thrilled to find out that they'd influenced everybody, including the Beatles and all kinds of people. I loved lovely singing voices. I loved the sound of a beautiful voice. I loved also rock and roll, but Elvis had a beautiful voice. And then all kinds of people like Matt Monro had beautiful voices, Doris Day. These are early, but Doris before my time. But they didn't stop. And then anybody who had a lovely voice, I loved. And then occasionally just a lovely, extraordinary song, so you could get the Specials and Ghost Town and things like that, or the Fun Boy 3, and suddenly, through having a child of my own and him growing up, you suddenly listen to Blondie singing Heart of Glass through his ears, or and probably his eyes, fall in love with Blondie singing Heart of Glass. Not that I would ever buy it, but I would get, this is lovely, darling, well done you. And occasionally he'd play me a piece of music and I'd go, jolly, jolly nice.
The thing about these podcasts is that I'm learning a great deal more than I knew before, to be frank.
Tell me, no, but look, I've gone droning on about why.
No, I've more questions.
I'm allowed to ask, you can ask that later. Stevie, when you were small, did you want to play the piano? Did you want to sing? Did you want to, what did you do first?
I remember very clearly that my grandparents, who lived only 50 yards up the road, had a harmonium, a pedal harmonium.
Mm.
Which, of course, as a child, one always wanted to fiddle around with.
A lot of people had pianos in the front room, but a harmonium, what is a harmonium?
Well, it's a kind of organ. It has two pedals to blow the air. So the faster you pedal, the more air you get. So the more stops you can pull out,
which provides
different sounds.
Oh, okay. So it's like an organ.
It's like a sideboard.
Yes.
With a full-length keyboard of several octaves. But it works on the same principle as organs do, which is on wind.
Yeah.
Because you need wind to blow across pipes for an organ. And so you pedal like mad.
Mm.
And you really had to work quite hard to keep the sound consistent. Because if you lost a...
It's like a gramophone running down, a wind-up gramophone.
Which was all very amusing.
Yeah.
And they used harmoniums a lot in churches that couldn't afford an organ. It's extraordinary because the story of my grandparents is pretty much like your parents and your family in that they never learnt an instrument, but they were regular churchgoers and they were also ballroom dancers and so they loved dance music. Their 78s, all of which I have on my shelves here, are absolutely extraordinary. So how did they get a harmonium in the house? All I can say is probably at some stage they thought they should have, and somehow this instrument found its way into my granny's house. I was always aware that my father and mother loved music. They both had a great love for Kathleen Ferrier and Alfred Deller, the countertenor.
Yeah. What's a countertenor?
A countertenor is a male falsetto voice.
Oh.
They both absolutely adored Alfred Deller. who was the first, really, of the generation that we now benefit so much from.
Mm.
We wouldn't have them if Alfred Deller hadn't started the trend.
Did they come from castrati, those poor people who
no,
had...
That's a bit of a myth.
But they had high voices.
Yes, but they had their testicles taken away from them before their voices broke.
Oh, I see. So they never had a broken voice.
No.
What era was this? What time?
About the middle 1650s, up through Handel's time, up to about 1800.
And then it just fell out of fashion. It was horrible. It was pretty grim practice, wasn't it?
Yes, I'm not... There were castrati still singing much, much, much later.
There's a recording of one I've heard.
Yes, one of the earliest recordings of all.
I think I remember his name was Alessandro Moreschi, known as the last castrati, who sang Ave Maria. And the recording was captured on one of the earliest recording devices, a wax phonograph. The sound makes your heart break. It's a particularly tragic, because it's high. It's a high voice. It ought to be similar to a soprano, but it's not.
But the career brought great wealth and fame. So, of course, parents and, teachers and maestro di cappella would sort of, I guess, find people and promise them the world. And some of them, indeed, became incredibly famous. So in Handel's time, he wrote a lot of roles in his operas for the castrati.
Did he?
Who became incredibly famous.
Yeah.
And very wealthy.
Yeah.
Because people absolutely loved the quality of sound.
Are those parts now sung by countertenors?
Increasingly, countertenors are now singing higher.
Ooh.
And with voice production that's much more similar to voice production of a woman. But in Alfred Deller's day, the range was small and the repertoire was pretty much Purcell and Dowland lute songs, but with a smaller range. My father loved it so much that he became a countertenor.
Gosh.
And began to sing in the church choir where he met my mother. But in answer to your question, my parents wanted all three of us siblings to have music lessons.
Mm.
And I had my first piano lesson when I was 5. And then I had a second teacher at the same time because the first teacher was more into the theory and the other piano teacher concentrated much more on fingerwork.
You must have been quite smart even then, because at 5 to have
it.
Two piano teachers. Yes, what did you do? How did this love manifest itself? That you used to play, used to sight read hymns, didn't you?
Well,
you used to put all the hymn books up and play anything.
When I was 6 or 7, I couldn't stay off it.
But you just played and played and played?
Yes, to the huge annoyance of my brother and sister. Because we had a small house and the piano was in the same room as the sitting room and the dining table.
Mm.
And so I was always on it. And I've never forgotten it. The cry would always go up within about 10 seconds of my putting my hands on the keyboard, must you do that now?
Play me one piece when you were a little person, what you might have played that made Lindy and Chris go, please, get rid of this boy. Play it now.
I didn't.
Stephen walks across to the piano.
Things, but it was probably Mozart or...
Stephen walks back, sits down. Yeah, but...
But my point is, that I'd like to make, is that I was very keen, I couldn't be kept off the piano, and I was just enthusiastic.
Mm. You've gone to choir... I'm jumping here. You've gone to choir school, but now you're 13 and you're at King's School, Canterbury, and... You love music and you're a musician and people know you as the musician Stephen Barlow. Smart aleck. Anyway, at the same time, you fall in love with different kinds of music. What music did you love as a teenager?
Well...
Look, a smile crept over his face. Tell me their names.
Well, there was a lot of Bee Gees played, and in due course, there was quite a lot of Pink Floyd, and sooner or later was Led Zepp, with whom I
for the younger,
still
for the younger listener, I'd like to say that's Led Zeppelin. Some people don't know Led Zepp, and you kind of snapped your fingers and tossed your hair back as you said it. There was something about Led Zeppelin, Led Zepp, which captured our generation.
Absolutely. The cultural significance, if we knew what that was not lost on me and my friends at school at all. I'm thinking especially of the guitar solo on Shook, which for me and so many other teenagers of the 70s encompassed everything.
And anybody else? Did you?
Who we were infected, of course, yeah. by it.
Beatles, we
sisters
all love.
Of boys that were your friends, and the Beatles, huge. The Beatles were always around.
But I was, did you like the Stones and the Who and things as much?
No, the Stones weren't for me.
No, because? I don't want this to be a... I don't want Mick ringing up and going, why didn't Stephen like me? I don't want that.
No, look, no one has to like everything. I mean, it's not a dislike.
But Simon and Garfunkel, that was beautiful music. And extremely, I think Paul Simon is just a complete wizard. You know?
Yeah, I love
Stevie
that.
Wonder. You
I
adored Stevie music. Wonder, didn't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, I loved his music. Yeah, yeah. I love a stash of music across all the genres. And I particularly love jazz and big band.
And I can remember when I very first met you and I said I'd heard Ella Fitzgerald live.
Well,
and your brown eyes turned to green because you were so jealous. Because she's
one of the most extraordinary artists. But you see, the joy about all of this was that one was immersed in music of all kinds. And particularly because you were mixing with and spending a lot of time with other people whose music was infected. And you had no right to say, no, you can't play that because I don't like it. You took it and you got to know it.
Did you find any division between the music that you loved, the music you were playing? Because, of course, you were doing a lot of church music at that time.
A lot of all kinds of music.
And by this time you were playing the organ.
Yeah.
Did that take you back to the harpsichord days? No, because you could never really play the harpsichord. What was it
never
about the organ?
Never got a chance to play harpsichord until I was about 17 or 18.
Did somebody say, Barlow, we think you'd do well on the organ? Great Alan Wicks, your great mentor.
No, every chorister at Canterbury Cathedral
had a go at the organ.
Just fell in love with the organ. Oh. I mean, it's the king of instruments. it has every conceivable sound option you can imagine. So
tell me how you get
those. It's total world domination when you're playing
because,
a cathedral organ.
Look, we know you've got dancing feet. You've got to have all the different pedals. Then you've got several layers of keyboards. Then you've got a mass of stops on each side. This seems to be molto complicado, but you like it. You love that.
Well, I was falling in love with orchestral music a lot. And I was helped a lot by wonderful teachers, two in particular. Robert Scott was a wonderful pianist and cellist and all-round musician. He grabbed me at one point and sat me down, gave me a huge score, heavy, and I opened it up and it said Das Rheingold. And he said, listen to that and tell me what you think.
So now you are 15 or 16, and your teacher, the wonderful Robert Scott, puts this score in your hands, and it's called Das Rheingold. How was it different from anything you'd ever seen before?
Well, it was the scale of it. The grandeur, the lengths of phrases, the atmospheres, the complete sense of the widest knowledge that that Wagner had, and but just the scale of it and the beauty of it, the imagination.
This is Wagner's Rheingold, and it would be the full orchestral score, so all the instruments, all the voice, everything written down in that.
Yes.
And how much? It's kind of half a. It's not even half a minute per page, is it? Sometimes only 10 seconds.
It can whiz past
it. You're whizzing past it. And you were listening to it, and you were also reading it at the same time.
Yeah.
Did you find it very... Can I just ask you something? Did you find it very difficult? Because when I look at a full score, you just go, blimey, O'Reilly, because you've got everything. Tell me how it is laid out. Is it violins
at the
top?
There's a structure. So you've got the woodwinds at the top.
Woodwinds.
So it goes in descending order down the score. Flutes, oboes, clarinets, bassoons, horns, trumpets, trombones, tuba, percussion, harp, and strings, violins, violas, cello,
bass. Then they put the voices in somewhere in the middle usually, don't they?
It's usually above the string section.
Yeah. And why do you find this so easy to read these, all playing different things at the same time?
Well, it wasn't easy when I first started doing it. When I was 11, a friend of mine at the choir school, whose father was a jazz pianist, his father gave him as a present, because he was a wonderfully precocious, David Blizzard is his name, wonderfully precocious, extraordinarily talented musician. And his father knew that. And he gave him an LP of The Rite of Spring by Stravinsky and the full score. And David said, come on, I've asked the headmaster whether we can go and listen to this on his hi-fi. And he did. Roddy Williams, the headmaster at the choir school, said, yes, by all means. And I remember sitting there with David, who was a year older than me, turning the pages of the score in absolute wonderment.
What was it about Stravinsky and The Rite of Spring specifically, Stevie?
Well, specifically everything.
You've always told me this. You said it absolutely hit you like a lightning bolt.
Yeah, well, and the audience, of course, at the time, at the first performance, was in riot with people fighting. Mm. It was a really raucous riot. Because there were sounds in it that no one had ever heard. And to anybody that listens to The Rite of Spring now, there will be things in there that you won't have come across. But particularly the last movement, which is just the most brutal and joyful rhythm and vast brass and strings. It literally does blow your mind.
Which piece is it? What is it? Which part of it?
The Danse Sacrale, the finale. So I was already completely bowled over by the possibilities of an orchestra and the plain excitement, the variety of sounds. Because all of those instruments I said in an orchestral score, they all have widely differing sounds. And so a great composer will put the instruments together in a creative way to create a different sound. So I was falling in love, and my teens really were falling in love with orchestral music and the opportunity. And the organ, of course, was my own orchestra, because you have ranks and ranks. By rank, I mean a sort of block of stops of different sounds, diapasons, flutes, mixtures, which are two or three notes, much higher than the note you're playing. So you had four or five ranks of stops to choose and blend. So it was a kaleidoscope of inspiration that one was going through.
Were you attending live concerts or going to listen to...
Yeah, occasionally.
...virtuosi pianists and things like that?
Occasionally. But the awful thing about that is that when you're 15, 16, in any... if you're a sportsman, you're going to hero worship at the same time as saying, no, he was bad, he missed that kick, he's no good. And I'm afraid I had to have my shins kicked quite a lot, because if Yehudi Menuhin, I saw Yehudi Menuhin play all six Bach suites, and Alan Wicks, sitting next to me, said, "Well, what do you think?" And I said, "Well, he played a bit out of tune." And I think if Alan could have kicked me extremely hard, he would have done. Because you're so critical. You're building your judgment. And of course, now I would hear Yehudi Menuhin, and he certainly wouldn't play out of tune, frankly, now. Because if he did, it was still magic.
That's sort of taken us through our teens and up to the next part of leaving school and going forward. And it sort of almost brought me to the part where I want to say, this is what I wanted us to do in these shows, which is to talk. Me asking and being, let's say, the average listener, and you being above average musician who's able to give answers about music. I want this programme to let us understand more about what it is in music that affects us all so colossally. And we can explore that later on. We can't explore it all now.
We'll probably have...
What do you want to play us out with?
I have a feeling it should be one of your great loves.
One of my great loves. So can we? Can I have Offenbach's Barcarolle, that lovely rocking... Barcarolle, of course, a bark is a boat, and the Barcarolle, so it's a rowing song.
It's a Venetian gondola's song.
And this is just heaven.
It's one of the most divine, simple, magical melodies.
That's episode one. That's pod one of Joanna and the Maestro. Thank you for listening, and we're going to be back next week. Hurrah! Stevie, we've done it.
We certainly have.
In this episode, you've heard the following music: Beethoven's Symphony No. 6 in F major, Opus 68, Pastoral, First Movement, performed by the Vienna Philharmonic and conducted by Karl Böhm. And the record company was Deutsche Grammophon. Mozart's Serenade No. 13 for strings in G major, K525, performed by Heidelberg Symphony Orchestra and Arthur Garbarek, and conducted by Eric Klemperer. And the record company was Big Joke Music. The Tales of Hoffmann, Barcarolle, by Jacques Offenbach, performed by the London Philharmonic Orchestra and conducted by David Parry, and the record company was X5 Music Group. Ave Maria, by Johann Sebastian Bach and Charles Gounod, performed by Alessandro Moreschi, and the record company was Discover Classical Music. Mozart's Piano Sonata No. 16 in C major, K545, Second Movement, performed by Stephen Barlow. You Shook Me, written by Jay Lenoir and Willie Dixon and performed by Led Zeppelin, published by BMG Rights Management UK Limited and Jewel Music Publishing Company Limited, and the record company was Atlantic Recording Corporation, a Warner Music Group company. Wagner's Das Rheingold, Prelude, performed by Dadesta Kniplova, Fritz Uhl, Gerald McKee, and the Grosse Sinfonieorchester, and conducted by Hans Swarovski. The record company was SLG LLC. Igor Stravinsky's The Rite of Spring, Danse Sacrale, performed by the Columbia Symphony Orchestra and conducted by Igor Stravinsky, published by Hawks & Son London Limited, and the record company was Sony BMG Music Entertainment. All music for the intro is supplied courtesy of Naxos Music UK. Puccini's Turandot, Act 3, Scene 2, 10.000 anni al nostro imperatore, performed by Malaga Philharmonic Orchestra, Giovanna Cassola and Alexander Rabari, licensed courtesy of Naxos Music UK Limited. Mozart's Exultate Jubilate, K165, performed by Pretty Coles, Camerata Casovia, and conducted by Johannes Wildner, licensed courtesy of Naxos Music UK Limited. Beethoven's Violin Concerto in D major, Opus 61, Third Movement, performed by Slovak Philharmonic Orchestra, Takako Nishizaki and Kenneth Jean, licensed courtesy of Naxos Music UK Limited.